From the campus of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Future Focus Now, giving you great conversations with great guests from Winston-Salem State University and beyond. And now your host, WSSU Chancellor, Elwood L. Robinson.
My guest tonight writes, "I hear my ancestors whispering in my ear, daughter, you were called just for this moment. This mission to seek justice runs deep in my veins. I'm the great-granddaughter of Julius Caesar Judkins, one of the first African-American males to graduate from Northwestern University's law school in 1915. Shortly after I was admitted to Northwestern University in 1997, nearly 9 decades after my great-grandfather started his journey at our alma mater, I would learn about his extraordinary accomplishments as a civil rights attorney in Grant County, Marion, Indiana. My guest tonight, Amber K. Brooks, MD, is a board-certified anesthesiologist and comprehensive pain medicine physician at Wake Forest Baptist Health. She has demonstrated an unwavering commitment to improving patient care, as highlighted by her academic endeavors in the area of clinical leadership, clinical research, and education, which earned her promotion to professor of anesthesiology at Wake Forest Baptist Health in 2017. She's recently focused her transition from a fully clinical practice towards a clinical research career. She's the principal investigator of 2 NIH-funded grants that leverage technology and electronic health record to deliver non-pharmaceutical treatments to a vulnerable population, older adults with chronic pain. She was recently selected as the associate editor for Pain Medicine, section on pain and aging. Dr. Brooks attended the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine from 2001 to 2005. She finished her intern year at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in 2006. She completed her anesthesia residency training at the University of Birmingham in Alabama in 2009 and pain management fellowship at the Cleveland Clinic Foundation in 2010. As a wife and mother of 2 young girls, Dr. Brooks has learned the importance of patience, compassion, and agape love. She enjoys traveling, all things fitness, outdoor cycling, and fine dining. She successfully completed her first triathlon in 2018. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure, it is my honor to welcome Future Focus tonight, Dr. Amber Brooks.
Good
there
evening.
She is. There you are.
Thank you so much for that kind introduction.
No, thank you for joining us tonight. We're delighted to have you as part of Future Focus Now. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while since I knew you were going to be on a guest. How are you, by the way? We began this period. We've been in difficult situations for the past 14 months. How are you? How are you doing? How's your family? How are the daughters? How's everything going?
You know, Chancellor, it's 1 minute, 1 hour, 1 day at a time, literally.
Yeah. But everybody's cool. It's good. Everybody's good.
Everybody is good. I cannot complain. Extremely blessed.
All right. So there's so many things that we can get to. We're going to get to a bunch of things tonight. So we thank you for joining us and being part of the discussion. We'll get into the whole idea of pain management. I tweeted and I put on Facebook that I was going to have a pain management specialist with me tonight. And so people are interested in how to manage their pain. We'll talk about sickle cell disease. And mm-hmm. If you don't know this, But there are two things, your first two areas, pain management and sickle cell disease, is what I started my career almost 40 years ago. I did my internship in pain management at Duke Medical Center in 1983. And I've worked tirelessly with a colleague and a bunch of colleagues around the country looking at pain management in the area of sickle cell disease. We probably published and probably had presentation, maybe 50 or so scientific presentations and publications in the area of sickle cell disease and pain. And so you and I have a lot in common.
Yes, I love it. That's outstanding, Chancellor.
Yeah, so that's really great. So tell us before we get started, I received this afternoon an amazing story about your life. And this is a story that was told back in February, and it talks about how you got involved in medicine. Mm-hmm. And it talks a little bit about your history. It talks about your great-grandfather. Take us through that. But what I'm most interested in as a physician at Wake Forest Baptist, why was it important to be portrayed in that manner?
Absolutely. So I want to start by saying that I have no physicians on either side of my family. So this really was a God-given calling for me. And it wasn't until I really was approaching adulthood that I just really, I really appreciated the shoes in which I was filling, the legacy for which I was fulfilling. So as I told that story, I penned that story in February during Black History Month at about 2 a.m. in the morning. I just poured my soul into it. And I just started to connect the dots between this rich legacy of having a great-grandfather who was one of the first African-American males to graduate from Northwestern, and then to have his son, my grandfather, who I unfortunately never got a chance to meet. He died very young at 35 from complications of high blood pressure. So I actually never got a chance to meet him. But a little known fact, I was born on October 22nd, and that's the day that this grandfather actually died, was October 22nd. And so my grandmother always told me that it was, just an extreme blessing and a relief of grief to have me enter the world the same day that that he departed this world. My I have another grandfather who also departed this earth on October 22nd. And so, I don't know how many people kind of believe in that rebirth process or fulfilling that legacy, but I strongly believe that I was put on this earth to continue the strong legacies that they started.
Right. And so how have you used that? Tell a little bit about the story. If those of you, you can go to my Facebook page. The story is posted on my page to get a more in-depth kind of analysis about her life. Take us through a little bit about the story.
Yeah, so my great-grandfather, he was a civil rights attorney in a small town in Indiana called Marion, Indiana. And, you know, a lot of people believe that, discrimination or lynchings or a racial discord didn't exist to the same extent in the Midwest as it did, for example, in the South. And that just simply isn't true. It may have not been as in your face, but it definitely existed. And so the story that I describe is one in which my great-grandfather and one of his law partners were fighting for justice for some sisters, Black female sisters, who were not allowed to eat at a diner in town. And they fought all odds and actually initially won the case. Each of these women were awarded $25 back in the mid-1900s, which was a lot of money. And they were, it was a jury of 12 white men, which was unheard of at that time to be, to side with these Black females. Unfortunately, the story didn't end that way. There were lots of appeals that that happened over the years. And ultimately, my grandfather and his law partner eventually ended up losing the case in the appeal process. But what the story tells me is that we must persevere no matter what. We must always seek justice. Oftentimes, we may not have the resources. We may not have the support. We may not have the backing. And yet, we push forward.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I found the story extremely moving. But my question to you is, why was it important for you to have that story told at this time and at Wake Forest?
Yeah, so I think it takes a certain amount of bravery to tell that story, Chancellor. And honestly, you know, I'll keep it 100% real with you on your show. You know, I don't know if I would have had that same bravery several years ago to share that story so openly. I think that all of the attention, this new attention, this new focus on racial injustice and social injustice that occurred a year ago, and how timely that we would be sitting here today having this conversation with, you know, the verdict that was delivered in the Derek Chauvin case today. I think it has allowed us to reimagine and to have difficult conversations and transparent conversations about what equity and justice really mean in this country, in this state, and even at Wake Forest Baptist Health.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, thank you for sharing that. We appreciate that story. I want everyone to go to my Facebook page, take a look at that story. And that has been central to your work and to your trajectory throughout your educational experience. That has stayed with you. You are somewhat of a trailblazer in a sense that you're in a profession that we don't see a lot of women, and now you're there, particularly in anesthesiology. But tell us about women and science and why it's important and what you've tried to do to get more women in science. I know that's a big area for you.
Absolutely. I strongly believe that, you know, in terms of science and particularly in healthcare, that the population that we serve, that the workforce should resemble the population that we serve. We know we have a lot of evidence that suggests that when there are shared experiences, shared backgrounds, shared race and ethnicity, shared gender experiences, that patient outcomes in healthcare are improved. And so, and in addition, we know that diverse teams are stronger teams. We have better outcomes. We're able to brainstorm ideas. We're able to come up with better solutions when we are diverse in every single way, whether that be gender, sexual orientation, religious affiliation, or race or ethnicity. We know that diversity builds strong teams.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you for sharing that. We appreciate that. You knew you wanted to be a doctor at age 12?
I did. And so, you know, as a little bit of background, my dad also has a law background. My mother was in psychology as well, and she went on to be a human resource director. I have many teachers and attorneys in my family, but there were no physicians in my immediate or just even smaller extended family. So this really truly was a God-given calling. I remember distinctly one day coming home, telling my parents I was going to be a physician. And my parents, especially my father, said, well, you know, this is going to be hard work. And so, you know, this is no joke. He always talked to me about the three D's, you know, determination, dedication, and oh my gosh, and if he's watching, he's going to kill me for not remembering the third D. But, you know, these were the things that were ingrained in me as a little girl. And so honestly, I was just very, very fortunate and very blessed to have parents who told me I could do anything that I wanted to.
That's amazing. And so take us through the journey. I mean, you're at 12, you made up your mind, you're going to be a physician. Your dad tells you how difficult it is, but that doesn't dissuade you. I mean, you are laser focused. Tell us a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, so, you know, it was a lot of long hours. You know, I will be honest, not many of my friends in grade school or high school or even college. It's so funny to talk to my college friends because they're like, Amber, we don't even really remember seeing you that much. And I'm like, yeah, because I was studying. You know, I was in the library. You know, I had a work study job in the library so that I could kill two birds with one stone. I could study and be in a quiet environment and make a little bit of money on the side. So there was a lot of sacrifice involved in those years. And, you know, honestly, Chancellor, there was a lot of failure, too. There was a lot of rejection and just a lot of perseverance saying, no, this is, you know, I'm not going to let anything deter me from my ultimate goal of becoming a physician. This is my calling. And I'm not going to let anything or anybody get in my way of that.
I think that's an important lesson, particularly for students today and those who are pursuing science careers or careers in medicine, is that it's not going to be easy and there are going to be some difficult moments and you're going to have some setbacks, but you got to persevere. I like the term that you use about persevering in terms of getting that. So I'm interested in terms of the Northwestern, because now you end up at Northwestern. Your great-grandfather, 1915, is at Northwestern University. One, did you know that before you got to Northwestern?
So I think that as a child, I may have been told that, but it wasn't until, so we had this project. The Black students, we used to hang out at a house on the main block of Northwestern, and it was called the Black House. And so one of our professors wanted us to do a legacy project. And so she encouraged us to think about any connections that we may have had to Northwestern, you know, family members who may have who have gone to Northwestern. But long story short, she was putting together, she was a history professor, and she was putting together she wanted us to put together a quilt that told our joint stories. And so I started doing a little bit of digging and researching and talking to my dad. And he said, yeah, you know, your great grandfather was one of the first Black males to graduate from Northwestern in 1915. And sure enough, that was the piece of the quilt that I think still stands in the Black House to this day.
Wow. And so, I mean, it's there. It's your piece of the quilt. It wasn't just your quilt, but it was all the students' quilt coming together to make that.
Right. Yeah. I think mine said, you know, I had my grandfather's name and, you know, 1915 for the year that he finished law school.
Yeah. Now, it's one thing to, you know, say at 12, you want to become a doctor. And it's another thing to kind of get there.
Right.
But tell us in terms of your specialty areas, how did that come about? How did you decide what you wanted to really do with being a physician?
So I will tell you, I stumbled into anesthesiology. I was like 100% sure that I was going to go into obstetrics gynecology. And that's because I worked on my free time on the weekends. You would find me on Saturday morning from 7 a.m. until about 5 p.m. in Dr. James Lawrence's office. He was one of the few Black male practicing obstetrician gynecologist in the area near where I went to school in Evanston, Illinois. And so I worked with him as much as I could, just soaking up anything that he could teach me. And so I worked there all 4 years that I was in undergrad. And so just that experience, having, you know, working with someone who looks like me, you know, just really sealed the deal that I was going to do obstetrics gynecology. I mean, he taught me everything that I needed to know about the path to get to medical school and to pursue a career in obstetrics gynecology. And then what happened? I got to medical school. I got to my third year and it was one of my first rotations. And I did the rotation and I said, oh my goodness, this is not for me. So thankfully, later on in my training, I was exposed to the field of anesthesiology Honestly, because I didn't have any medical people in my family or in my network, I didn't even really know what anesthesia was, to be quite honest. But it was during that experience, during my medical training, that I got exposure to the field. I got in contact with some really great mentors who guided me on how I could become an anesthesiologist.
Yeah, but when I think about anesthesiology, and I think about it being a risky profession. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just say that. I mean, this is just me. I mean, you need to clear it up for me because of the kind of work that you do and where you are ultimately putting folks. What was it about anesthesiology? What excited you about it? And and when did you say, you know, this is for me?
Yeah, so I love doing things with my hands. And so there's a lot of procedural aspects to anesthesiology. In addition, I love physiology. So I love, I love to learn about the way all of the ways that the body works. And then lastly, I wouldn't necessarily call myself like a thrill seeker or an adrenaline seeker, but I am rather impatient. So
you but you do triathlons, you run marathons, and you, I mean.
But that's different. That's different. Like, so, but you know, so in anesthesia, so when you're in the operating room, you can give someone a medicine to raise or lower their blood pressure. And in minutes, sometimes less than that, you can see that it worked or it didn't work. Whereas, you know, in primary care, I could give you a blood pressure pill and then I got to see you back in 4 weeks. You have to bring in all of your measurements of your blood pressure. And there, that's a certain patience that's required for that. So I do like, you know, in the anesthesia, there's just saying that, you know, 95% of the time, everything is great, but you don't prepare for the 95% of the time that's going to be great. You're prepared for the 5% of sheer terror where something can go disastrously wrong, you know, just like that.
Yeah. And so now you are, you know, you do your residency, you complete all of this, and now you end up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. How did you get to Winston-Salem, North Carolina?
Okay, Chancellor, you want to know the truth?
You mean,
and if my husband's watching, he's going to be like, Amber, that's not the way it went down. But honestly, I was drugged here kicking and screaming. So that's sort of the truth, but not really. So, my husband and I, we met when we were both on faculty at University of Alabama at Birmingham, UAB. And he got an opportunity to take a position at North Carolina A&T. He is promoted. He is now professor of counselor education at North Carolina A&T.
At North Carolina A&T? is he in the house? Is he in the house right now?
So I'm in my work office because my kids would never let me be great to do this interview. So,
tell him I got a bone to pick with him. Talk to my A&T. All right.
Yes. So he got an opportunity like he just could not pass up. He was so excited to return to an HBCU. He's a graduate of Morehouse. And so we came here really because of that job opportunity. And I also happened to have opportunity to take a position at Baptist. But it was really what I was doing previously at UAB. Those same opportunities did not exist at the time at Baptist. And so it was really an opportunity for me to reinvent myself, recreate myself, reimagine what I wanted my career to look like.
Well, I mean, that's pretty extraordinary. I mm-hmm. mean, coming to a place and then ending up at Baptist. And now tell us a little bit about what you do. What's your day like and what do you do? And then I want to get into some very specific areas that we can talk to our audience about.
Absolutely. So I joined faculty at Baptist in 2013, really at the height of the opioid epidemic. And at the time, my practice was part anesthesia. So being in the operating room, putting people to sleep, more importantly, waking them up. And also spending time treating patients with a variety of different chronic and at that time acute pain conditions. But the opioid epidemic hit, and it was an opportunity. I really found myself becoming frustrated at the lack of resources, the lack of treatment options for some of my more vulnerable populations, especially older adults. And so that led me on a journey that I could never have imagined myself for myself, which was to pursue clinical research. And so I had a lot of very early luck with being funded. And so my practice now is part clinical research. So looking at finding ways to treat older adults with chronic pain with non-medication interventions. And then I spend the other part of my time seeing patients in clinic, like I was in clinic today, seeing patients. The first half of my morning was spent doing a variety of different pain procedures. And then the second half of my day was spent evaluating patients who had new consults for chronic pain, a variety of chronic pain conditions.
All right. Well, great. Now let's start with the pandemic. I mean, so we've been in this thing for 14, 15 months. I lose count every day in terms of where we are.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about what your life has been like during the pandemic. I know and have read your bio, and you talked a little bit about this earlier about health disparities. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about health disparities, but also I want you, because of your association with, you know, with the healthcare industry, with hospitals, take us through some of the issues that we're facing today, certainly around testing and vaccination.
Absolutely. So I really think that this double pandemic of COVID-19, as well as social and racial injustice, really highlighted, or I should say re-highlighted, disparities that have long existed. And the COVID really just exacerbated those disparities. We know that brown and black people are 4 times more likely to die from COVID-related illnesses as compared to our white counterparts. And the reasons for that are complex, but include access to care. It includes having more chronic comorbid conditions that put us at risk for COVID-related illnesses. Systemic racism in medicine plays a part in those disparities, and so on and so forth. So myself and other physicians here at Baptist and also in our greater community, I think that those of us who are dedicated to the cause in terms of impacting change in health disparities have to lead by example. So, you know, when I had my chance to get vaccinated, I did not hesitate because I knew that I wanted to lead by example. I wanted to be transparent and share my experience with getting the vaccine. I wanted to be a source of information for people. To ask me questions and to disseminate information and facts about getting the vaccine.
Yeah, and so you also have an interest when we think about the work that you do primarily in terms of older adults. Mm-hmm. So you do have a geriatrics type flavor. Talk to us a little bit about how you got into that, and talk a little bit about some of the issues that older adults are having today. I'll tell you that when I first started out, I was younger then, and I used to work with older adults. Now that I'm an older adult, it's even more important than when I was younger. But take us through some of the issues today that are not necessarily unique, but very specific to older adults.
Yeah, so I will start by sharing a personal story about my grandmother. My grandmother passed away a few years ago, but she was a vibrant woman and really remained sharp into her last days. She died just a few days short of her 94th birthday. But unfortunately, the last like 5 to 10 years of her life were marked with extreme difficulties with chronic pain. She had chronic low back pain, and she also had diabetic peripheral neuropathy, which was very painful for her. And it interfered with all of the things that she loved to do. Like, one of her favorite pastimes was playing bridge. And I always knew it was a bad pain day if she decided that she wasn't going to go to bridge, because that she loved playing bridge, and she could play with the best of them. Imagine me, the board certified pain management physician and anesthesiologist, the frustration of not even, not being able to really help my own grandmother, my own flesh and blood, the way that I really wanted to. She was tried on a variety of different pain medications that either caused intolerable side effects or that just didn't work. Some medicines that she may have been able to take were contraindicated because of her kidney function or because she was on blood thinners, and so she couldn't take certain pain medications. So all of that really led me down this path. That plus the opioid epidemic led me down this path to try to seek solutions and seek answers for this vulnerable population.
Yeah. So one of the things that I see, and I want to get your take on this, as a physician and an anesthesiologist, what I've noticed is that in a lot of older Americans, they take a lot of medication. So one of the questions that I got on my Facebook page was, how can you deal with pain, without medication? But here's my question is, I noticed a lot of older Americans have multiple prescriptions. I mean, 8, 10 sometimes. And I don't think that we have a good handle on how these drugs interact. And I'm not so sure what's going on with it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So what you're describing is what we call polypharmacy. And it's much more likely to occur in older adults because, medicine has advanced to such a point where we are living longer. But sometimes living longer doesn't necessarily mean that we have great quality of life or that we're in the best of health. And so we have a variety of different medications that can help, but you're exactly right. There are medications that can have interactions with one another, and pain medications in particular can cause a lot of issues in older adults because of the way that their renal function and their liver function changes over time, as I like to tell my older adults, as we mature.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. So take us through that questions about how do you manage pain without medication, particularly for older adults? What's your best advice or your best treatment for pain without significant medication?
Absolutely. So my research focuses on behavioral interventions that have three components. We focus on weight loss because we know that there's this common pathway of inflammation that exists between being overweight and having chronic pain. And so my target population in my research studies are usually older adults who are overweight or who are obese. And so what we do is we focus on weight loss, we focus on pain management skills, we do some mindfulness meditation or relaxation techniques. So the combination of those things to get people in a better place. I strongly believe that for arthritis conditions, especially, that movement is medicine. We know that the longer we sit and the longer that we remain sedentary, as we all have had more sedentary behavior in this pandemic, we know that the more likely we are to gain weight and the more likely we are to have our joints hurt. So we encourage people to move their bodies in whatever way they find enjoyable. So we're not talking about getting older adults on treadmills or having them run marathons. We're just simply talking about making sure that you're getting up and moving your body at least hourly. So we provide people with activity monitors that prompt them to get up and move their body throughout the day. We want to make sure that they're moving constantly throughout the day.
Yeah, you in my former life, many years ago when I was in pain management, I worked a lot with osteoarthritis, as well a little bit with rheumatoid arthritis, but behavioral interventions. As an anesthesiologist, what does the profession, how do they feel about you using these behavioral approaches?
You know, so it's very interesting that you say that, because I think that, pure medical doctors, I think, have been a little bit, may have been a little bit more reluctant to accept these behavioral interventions as, as real legit ways of addressing a variety of different conditions. But I think we've seen a shift, especially in pain management, because as the pendulum swings away from no longer prescribing strong or high dose narcotic or opioid medications, we have to have other modalities, other interventions, including behavioral interventions, to be able to test and to be able to prove that they're effective.
Yeah. What are we learning today about the developmental lifespan, just in terms of things, whether physicality or cognitions or even the holistic perspective about the mind-body kind of interactions? I was, once again, many years ago, dealing with a group when I was a young professor, my first or second year at North Carolina Central University, and met this group that said they were living to be 100, which I thought was really fascinating at the time. So fast forward in terms of where we are today, what would you suggest? What kind of lifestyle changes would you say people should implement in terms of living longer? Because we weren't really supposed to live this long. And now folks, now 80, 90, you want to be alive and vibrant. How do we get there and how do we maintain that?
So I think that movement is an important part, regular movement. And the older recommendations were that you get 30 minutes of exercise 5 times a week, so that you at least have 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity each week. We know that it is important to move your body, but we know for older adults that it can be in ways that are not necessarily that fit the moderate to vigorous category. That just moving your body, simply getting up from a sitting to a moving position, getting steps in throughout the day, again, in whatever way that you can, is beneficial not only for chronic pain, but you mentioned cognition. We know that there are some important associations between increased physical activity and improve cognition as we age. So this idea of moving our bodies is important for a lot of different areas in terms of holistic living and aging.
Great. Let's transition to Alzheimer's disease in terms of the work. A lot of folks are concerned about that. I've got a couple of questions on my Facebook page today about Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. What can we do to I don't know whether we want to just ward it off or anything like that, but maybe keep from having declines in cognition and ultimately maybe not getting Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, African-American, the prevalence of Alzheimer's disease in Blacks or African-American populations is higher than our white counterparts. We know that there is a hereditary component to Alzheimer's disease as well. So I think early recognition and early diagnosis is key. And so making sure that, if there's any changes in a family member or a friend in terms of cognition, that you make sure that we seek care earlier rather than later. Again, we know that moving our body is an important part of the treatment. There are lots of different medications that can also kind of slow the process that I am not qualified to speak about, because I'm not a geriatrician or Alzheimer's disease specialist. But I just think that early diagnoses and early recognition can be so key. And then the other thing, Chancellor, that you and I have had conversations about previously is the importance of having a support system for those that are caring for aging families with Alzheimer's disease, because caring for a family member or for a loved one with Alzheimer's disease can be very, very challenging.
I think that's extremely challenging and very stressful. And so many people out there today are caregivers. And I don't know if we spend a lot of time in terms of those individuals who are caretakers, you know, and I think we do, because not only do they have to deal with the issues related to having parents and loved ones, but they themselves also challenged with emotions, with depression, with anxiety, and all of those kinds of things. And so what would we recommend and to folks who are in that space today in terms of having to deal with it a little better?
So I think that one of the things that early diagnoses affords family members and loved ones who are caring for people with dementia or early onset Alzheimer's disease, it affords them time to come together with a plan. Far too often I see patients from a variety of different demographic backgrounds who you know, are in a little bit of denial about the situation. And so they turn, and instead of being in a position where they're able to be proactive and plan for the care of their family member, they find themselves in a reactive state. You know, for example, the family member has a fall, and now they're in a reactive state in trying to manage an already challenging situation. So I always, you know, I always encourage my older adults who may have, you know, may have a diagnosis of dementia or Alzheimer's, I always encourage the caregivers to start having early conversations, early as possible. Sometimes it's not possible, but the earlier the better, so that there can be a proactive plan in place.
Yeah. Dr. Brooks, I don't know. I hope that us as boomers, baby boomers, are doing this. But are we creating a better world, a better space for older individuals?
You know, that's a great question. I think that we are a work in progress. I see less ageism. I think that, you know, for those who are listening, you know, 2020 marked the first time in not just our nation's history, but our world's history, that we now have more adults ages 65 and older than we do children under the age of 5. So y'all, Chancellor, y'all are taking over.
There we go. I can't wait.
So, and because we are living longer, that means the healthcare, you know, the healthcare industry, we are taking care of more older adults. We're doing more operation for hip replacements, knee replacements, because older adults are living longer. And so we're seeing more older adults go under anesthesia, more older adults seeking healthcare. So I do think that as a healthcare body, we are starting to realize that it's here, it's happening. But I think we still have tons of work to do.
Yeah, I mean, that whole idea of ageism in medicine, I think it has been, and it may be changing now, very prevalent in your area, anesthesiology. Mm-hmm. There was a time in which, depending upon your age, people would not give you anesthesia.
Absolutely.
Has that changed, and how and what has caused that to change?
I think, you know, just education. I think we, you know, there was in the extreme ages, the extreme young and the extreme old, we know that anesthesia, you know, may have some, you know, have some different effects than it does on people who are not in those extreme ages. So I think that what has, you know, relaxed some of that ageism is just more research, more, you know, more facts about the effects of the long-term effects of anesthesia. And I think that we are starting to have a lot more conversations around quality of life and risk and benefits. And we have techniques and strategies to be able to risk stratify someone and tell them, you know, very transparently now what their risks are involved in terms of not just anesthesia, but what a recovery for a 90-year-old who's having, you know, who's had a broken hip, what their recovery is going to look like after they leave the hospital, because that's just as important as the day of surgery.
Yeah. Do we have enough information and enough data, enough research to be honest with older Americans? Can we honestly have a conversation about how they should be functioning physically or cognitively?
Yes, I do think we have enough information to have an honest and transparent discussion. And I think we have enough information to share where the gaps in knowledge are as well.
Yeah, so you do. So you're comfortable sitting down with someone who is 80 or 85 and saying, these are the kinds of things you should expect.
Absolutely. And I think that has been, that's been a huge shift just even since I was in medical school. I think the way in which we're having conversations around end of life care, and I'm not just talking about, you know, a very sudden end of life care issues, but I'm talking about more like chronic issues, more, you know, you're given more than 6 months to live and you want to know what your quality of life is going to be. We have a lot more data, I think, to have more transparent conversations with older adults about what to expect.
Yeah. Some of your work also has been done with sickle cell disease. Mm-hmm. How did you get into that? And what do you do with that in terms of pain management?
Yeah, so, you know, here at Baptist, because we are a tertiary care center, we see a variety of different patients, and that includes sickle cell patients. And sickle cell patients oftentimes present with something called sickle cell pain crises. And these crises, these pain crises can sometimes be unpredictable, and they can send them to the emergency room or get them hospitalized on a very frequent basis. So my division head, Dr. Hurley, and his some colleagues in hematology, who are the primary doctors that treat patients with sickle cell disease, and then some of the hospitalists are the doctors who take care of patients while they're in the hospital. They got together and they wanted to figure out if there was a better way to deliver care to sickle cell patients who had frequent contact with the Baptist healthcare system. And so they came up with a strategy and a protocol to better treat their pain. We know that sickle cell crisis pain can be multifaceted, and it's not just one pain medication that's going to get their pain better. And so this protocol allows us to use what we call multimodal pain management. So we use a variety of different pain medications and modalities to try to address their pain while they're an inpatient. And so myself and Dr. Hurley and a few other colleagues, we just recently had a paper accepted to Pain Medicine, and I will be sure to forward it to you, Chancellor, when it's published about our outcomes, which were, one of them was decreased hospital utilization and decreased length of stay in the hospital.
Yeah, very nice. I look forward to that. A lot of, in terms of pain, I know a lot of folks out there want to manage their pain. There are a couple things that, as a, you know, you also have a behavioral kind of slant to you. I like that, mm-hmm. that you've incorporated that into the work that you do. Talk to us a little bit about the importance of your emotions. The importance of making sure that we deal with things like depression that might be related to that as well.
Absolutely. So you bring up such an important point. You know, pain is multifaceted. And I always tell my patients that, for our viewers, we know that people who suffer from chronic pain, that we know that over 50% of those patients also have some type of coexisting psychiatric or psychological disorder, and they also may have a coexisting history of a substance use disorder. So it makes treating their chronic pain that much more challenging. So I always tell my chronic pain patients that we have to make sure that those other things are well controlled. We have to make sure that they're sleeping well, because we know that if you're not sleeping well, your pain is going to be that much harder to control. And it doesn't matter how many pain pills you get if you're not sleeping well. We also know that depression is an important, it's an important part of pain. And so we know that if the depression is not well controlled, that we'll have a hard time treating the pain. And so sometimes there are medicines that we choose that not only can address the depression, but can also address the pain symptoms. So it's very important to take all of that, that full, what we call that biopsychosocial model, take all of those things into consideration when we're treating someone holistically with chronic pain.
Thank you. Thank you for that. We appreciate that. Not a lot of time left, but last segment, let's talk about what we need to do in getting this pandemic under control. So now we're well into this. As a physician, we know that the pandemic has caused a number of problems. One of the problems is just having to divert our attention to it has now taken us away from being able to do, elective surgeries and all the kinds of things that we used to do pre-pandemic. Where are we with that in terms of being able to treat folks? And then our last thing I'll ask you is what we're doing in terms of vaccinations.
Yeah, so you bring up such an important point, and that reminds me of an older adult patient that I saw in my clinic about 2 months ago, and she was an older woman who had delayed care for a diabetic ulcer in her foot because she was just that deathly afraid of leaving her house, and so was the family member who was caring for her for fear of COVID. And so that is a prime example, Chancellor, of how COVID has affected our ability to deliver timely healthcare. And as a result of that delay in seeking care, by the time she got to me, it was very clear that she was going to need an amputation. And because the infection had spread not just to her toe, it had spread to a good part of her leg. She was probably going to need part of her limb amputated. And again, because she had delayed care, because we were at the height of the pandemic. So that, unfortunately, that story is not uncommon. Right. I think that, one of the keys to getting this pandemic under control is getting vaccinated. And I think that as more people get vaccinated and people are starting to have conversations about the risk and benefits, they're observing other people and how they're doing after the vaccine. I do feel like vaccine hesitancy has decreased somewhat. And so now the focus has to equally be on providing vaccine, making sure that every single person has access to receiving the vaccine. And so I was fortunate enough to participate as a volunteer at the community vaccine event, Chancellor, that you all had at Winston-Salem State University as a joint effort between Baptist and FEMA. And that day we vaccinated over 700 people. And many of them were people of color. And so we just have to be sure that as a community, we continue to work together, that the hospital system, Winston-Salem State, other community partners, that we continue to work together to make sure that every single person who is interested in being vaccinated has the opportunity and access to the vaccine.
Absolutely. And that's what we want to make sure. And we want to leave this show with folks understanding that it is important to get vaccinated, and because you're helping not only yourself, but you're helping others as well. So we want to continue down that road. Take us through in terms of, as we close out, we just got a couple minutes left, in terms of any information you'd like to provide to our audience about self-care, about taking care of themselves. I know that you really into exercise. So in our last few minutes together, talk to us about, how to stay healthy.
Absolutely. So I really enjoy exercising. For me, it's a form of stress relief. It's a time for me to focus on myself. My husband, fortunately, is also a huge advocate of staying healthy. I mean, since the day I've met him, I've always known him to be in that gym a couple of times a week. So I'm fortunate to have a partner who focuses on health just as much as I do. But I really think, especially for my mentees, who are oftentimes either pre-medical school students or who are medical school students or who are trainees in a variety of different fields in medicine, I always tell them that, you have to take care of yourself first. It's hard to pour from an empty cup. And so whatever it is that, that fills their cup, they need to do it, whether that be, whether that be listening to music, taking a walk, exercising, whatever it is that they need to do, they need to build that time into taking time out for themselves. It is so important. It's the only way that we can continue this important work of taking care of others and taking care of our community, is that we have to take care of ourselves first.
Thank you. And we're going to end on that. I think it's a great way to end the show. I know you came to Winston-Salem kicking and screaming. We are glad that you're here. You're such an integral part of the community. I see you in so many places volunteering your time. We certainly thank you for volunteering to be at Winston-Salem State University for our Spokes clinic. We were excited about that work and continue as we wrap that up. But that was so meaningful. And tell your husband, disregard my remark about the A&T Aggies. We love the Aggies. We love HBCUs, and we're glad that he's here as well. And I want to thank you. All the best to you and your family, your daughters, for being on Future Focus. So we thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Chancellor, for having me. I've enjoyed this time. I can't believe it's already over. It seemed like it went by like that.
It's always real quick. Always real quick when you have a great conversation. Thanks for joining us. And thank you, everyone out there, for joining us. And please join us next week for another great edition of Future Focus Now.